Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! You know what? I've been time traveling all day. Really. A couple of times I've had to check the clock and the calendar just to... Yeah, it's Tuesday. Tuesday. For some reason or another, I had it in my head that it was Wednesday. I think I'm trying to, you know, get Sherman to set the way-up machine for Wednesday because of my anticipation of what I hope will be an excellent conversation with David Novak, the director and creator of Burning the Future. He'll be along tomorrow. Tomorrow is Wednesday, right? For those of you who have trouble transitioning between programs because of the way the stream works here, just a little programming note. If you stop your player and restart your player, everything will get all happy. Just another day on the cutting razor's edge of technology that is life on the horn. So, the excellent conversation coming up tomorrow. And, of course, Friday we have Cindy Sheehan on the program. I think both conversations will be quite enlightening. And I encourage you to listen however you can. If you can listen live those evenings, great. If you can only listen in some sort of pre-recorded format, that's cool, too, because we are the new media. No terrestrial buggy whip radio here. No tired censorship rules. No worn out right-wing advertising medium. Just straight up facts. Just facts. And your thoughts and my thoughts. So, however you choose to listen. And as I noted, we've been reshuffled at iTunes. A lot of people have. And we're now under iTunes Radio Public. Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies. I don't know why. But we're waiting. They tell me that they will be creating a subsection of their iTunes Radio listings called Political, which we will go into at some point when they get done with it. So if you're looking for us in the old iTunes Radio talk spoken word, we ain't there anymore, I don't think. We're in Public. So, look there, but we are definitely there. Oh, dear. 3 minutes past 6 p.m., and where do we start? I don't know how we can start anywhere but at the most logical starting place. Well, wait, a couple of program notes. Once again this evening, Peter Godbold will be a rerun. He had hoped to be on the air this evening following my program. I had hoped as well. But server hell persists in the world of Peter Godbold, and he's determined to be back tomorrow evening. I know how frustrating this is for him, because I even, you know, we got up this morning and even had the gay bar across the street segment loaded and ready to go, and then got the, nope, Bob, I'm going to be in server hell again. Can't get around it. So, you know, yeah, you'll have that kind of thing. But where to start? Where to start this evening? Oh, dear. How about we start with some reputable journalism? How about we start with the Jerusalem Post? Where that newspaper reported... And then, of course, you know, the Bush administration, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, nudge as good as a wink to a blind man, say no more, flatly denied it. The Jerusalem Post reported that Israeli Army Radio, I don't know, they've got their own radio, they've got their own terrestrial radio. Israeli Army Radio reported that George W. Bush intends to attack Iran before the end of his term. It's that simple. And I can't help but remember what Ray McGovern said when I saw him speaking in Institute, West Virginia, a few weeks ago. And he noted that the critical date for attacking Iran, for the Israelis at least, is not any date that they acquire a sufficient amount of enriched uranium or build a bomb or start a reactor or anything. No, no, no. The critical date is January 20th, 2009, the last day that George Bush is in office. That's the critical date. Israeli Army Radio had quoted a top official in the Israeli government who claimed that a senior member in the Bush posse said in a closed meeting that Bush and Cheney were of the opinion that military action against Iran was called for. Well, almost 7 minutes into the program and we're getting near my first bad word. Well, damn it! And the only thing we've got standing, and I don't even know if this constitutes standing between it. You know, John Conyers issued a letter to George Bush last week or so. It was a week or so ago, wasn't it? Where he said, listen, if you attack Iran, we're going to start impeachment proceedings, period. I haven't seen anywhere, and I asked in the chat room, headonradionetwork.com chat room, nobody had an answer. I guess Nancy Capicciolosi went to the Mideast as well. But I haven't seen where Nancy Capicciolosi has smacked John Conyers down yet. And I don't know if she has. It may be one of those subtle delayed surrenders that Nancy Capicciolosi is so good at. But yeah, the official cited in the Israeli Army Radio piece, which was then subsequently cited by the Jerusalem Post, says that, quote, the hesitancy of Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was preventing the administration from deciding to launch an attack on Iran for the time being. But, you know, George Bush will waterboard his own people. I'm sure after a good simulated drowning, Condi Rice and Robert Gates will come right around. You know, spit the water out and say, I'll bomb them. Just don't do that to me no more. That was torture. Well, yes, it was. No, it wasn't. According to assessments in Israel, the recent turmoil in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is said to have de facto established control of the country, is being used to advance an American attack on Iran. It's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Just a beautiful thing. I bet you CNN's already got their camera positions all picked out, where they can watch the nighttime bombing of Tehran and Bushehr and, you know, some of the other Iranian hotspots. But they've already got their camera positions picked out, don't you? With the night vision scopes where all the explosions are all kind of green and stuff. What are you going to do when George starts his war with Iran? How are you going to take it? How are you going to feel about it? March in the streets? What? Remain calm? What? Wonder how much gasoline's going to cost the day after? Answer C. That's probably the response of the vast majority of America. Wonder how much gas is going to cost after George attacks Iran, without Iran ever having fired a shot in anger at us. He'll be 2-0 on so-called preemptive wars. What used to be called, back in the bad old days of the 20th century, wars of aggression. The White House said in a statement, quote, "The U.S. remains opposed to Iran's ambitions to obtain a nuclear weapon. To that end, we are working to bring tough diplomatic and economic pressure on the Iranians to get them to change their behavior and to halt their uranium enrichment program, and we can't wait till the bombs start falling." No, I added that part. But we've heard this song before, haven't we? We've seen the dance that goes with it. You know, the one where some spokes creep for the White House, like Dana Perineal, comes out and says, a military force would be the last option. When all the time, we know, just as when Ari Fleischer did it and the slithering Scott McClellan followed it up, we know all along it was the first option, and in fact, the only option. The White House went on in its little press release, "As the president has said, no president of the United States should ever take options off the table, but our preference and our actions for dealing with this matter remain through peaceful diplomatic means. Nothing has changed in that regard." See, the only true statement in that PR piece is that nothing has changed in that regard. Nothing has changed because the aching desire of the Bush administration has been for 7.5 long, tortured, miserable years to get a little something-something going with Iran, too. Because, you know, he's tired of Iraq, and he's bogged down in Iraq, and nothing's working in Iraq. Can't get the power on, can't get the toilets to flush, the buses and the planes and the trains don't go on time, the schools aren't open, there's open sewage in the streets, and little starving children eating dirt. Grandfathers dragged out of their houses and blown away in the middle of the night by one side or the other, including our own. And it's just not fun anymore. Where's the joy in that? It's sort of depressing, really. All the fun sort of dried up after Saddam swung from that rope. That was the last time George Bush had any fun with his little pet war in Iraq. So George wants to see the fireworks again.
Uncle Dick, I want to see stuff go boom some more, okay? Appease me, would you, Dick? Let me see some more stuff go boom. I like it when stuff goes boom. It was really fun when I was a little boy, and I used to cram the M-80s up the frogs' butts and blow them up. And it was... I liked that boom, too, but we got even bigger boom-booms now, Uncle Dick.
The words George Bush used to the Knesset last week when he publicly humiliated the American people.
America stands with you in firmly opposing Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions, permitting the world's leading sponsor of terror to possess the world's deadliest weapon would be an unforgivable betrayal of future generations. For the sake of peace, the world must not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
But he's certainly willing to betray future generations of American children. Sure thing. Because those are the ones who will pay in revenge. Those are the ones who will pay at the pump. Those are the ones who will pay in a devastated economy. God almighty. Turns your stomach, doesn't it? Sorry, not trying to be a bummer. This is just, it really is. This is hard to stomach. Dig it. Iran has no nuclear weapons. Iran has not to this day been proven by any form of competent proof to have a nuclear weapons program or program-related activities. They're enriching uranium, and they say they want to have nuclear power plants. And so far, that's all the proof there is. But that's not enough for the Israelis, and it's not enough for the lickspittle Bush administration. And it just makes me so sad as an American. It makes me so very, very sad as an American. It makes me ache as an American. Because this will unleash hell on earth in that region. And we live over here, so, you know, we don't have to worry about the missiles and the rockets and so forth raining down on neighborhoods in Israel or Iran. George can just pick up his shoe phone or whatever and order the devastation to begin in that region. And bear in mind, Iran doesn't have any nuclear weapons. Israel has over 200 of them. There's the real potential here for an outright holocaust. A holocaust that will take place in an airburst over Iran. And it just gives me the cold shivers thinking about it. It makes me fear for the future of our nation. You know, all those right-wing religion industry types who are all the time talking about the America needs to get back to God. If America would get back to God, so to speak, we wouldn't be talking about raining death on a nation that has never fired a shot at us. Iran has never left its territorial confines, not for over 500-600 years. But they're real scary. Why are they scary? Well, they're scary because we've said they're scary. And it's... Oh, by the way, just in case you were wondering, in his little jaunt abroad, so to speak, George did confirm that even though the Saudis told him to go pee up a rope, as far as oil prices were concerned, George did promise them a little something. George had some what you might want to call sweetening for the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What is it that we're all upset about in Iran? Nuclear weapons, right? Right? Yeah? Mm-hmm. And what is it that's the source of our fear of Iran getting nuclear weapons? That would be enriched uranium, right? Yeah, okay. Well, there's another country in the Mideast. Now, bear in mind, Israel is the only nuclear country in the Middle East. They have the capitals of all the Arab nations targeted with nuclear weapons. Iran doesn't have them, Iraq doesn't have them, Jordan doesn't have them, Syria doesn't have them, Egypt doesn't have them, Dubai, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, no nuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Pakistan is not part of the Middle East. That's South Asia. But guess who wants... couldn't even get a break at the pump in exchange for this. Damn, that's some jawboner, that George Bush. Went over to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and pledged to support the Saudi Arabian nuclear power program, including actually supplying the enriched uranium for Saudi nuclear reactors. gets a little harder every day not to just scream and throw something through a window that I can't afford to replace. Either the thing or the window, if we're worrying about the modifiers. Yeah. Sitting here having purple polka-dotted hissies and kittens with crocheted tails over the Iranians having enriched uranium. The Saudis don't have any, but we're going to give them some, because we can trust them. Oh, yeah, we can trust the Saudis. Wait a minute. I'm scratching my head here. There's something bothering me in the back of my brain. I can't quite put my finger on it. Darn, Saudis. Come on, help me here. Oh, yeah! The people who took down the World Trade Centers and attacked us on September the 11th, 2001, were... Iranians? Iraqis? Saudis! Well, no, Bob, that couldn't possibly be. I watched Dear Leader on Fox all the time, and he said it was Saddam. Oh, the price we're going to pay. Yeah, that's right. George Bush is going to give enriched uranium to a country whose religiously insane zealots hijacked airliners and flew them into the twin towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That's just nice. I mean, isn't that like, you know, when the schoolyard bully comes over and mashes you in the mouth, then you hand him a broken beer bottle and say, "Why don't you see what I had for lunch?" Lord God. We are going to give enriched uranium to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, where the crown sits not real solidly on the head of King, what is he, Abdullah? And we're not getting anything for it! We're not getting a damn thing for it. We're not getting a penny off the price at the pump for it. We're not getting an extra 100 barrels a day of Saudi production for it. Never mind the fact that the vast majority of oil imports to this country come from Canada, Mexico, and Venezuela. We'll talk about that later if you want to. But George Bush is going to give enriched uranium to the country whose sick, twisted mindset created the September 11th, 2001 monsters who helped turn this country on its ear. That makes all the marbles rattle around inside my tiny little mind. Can you fathom that? I'm sure that there's some really, really highly educated Republican who go, "Well, you know, Bob, that just goes to show that you're naive. You're gonna, you know, if we don't give the enriched uranium to the Saudis, well, you know, the Saudis will probably get it from like the Russians or something." And we can't be damaging our relationship with the Saudis. And this might be a long 3 hours tonight. Yeah, if you want to go over and hear all about this, Amy Goodman has a fascinating interview with Harvey Wasserman of freepress.org, editor of nukefree.org. I don't mind talking about what they do on what Amy Goodman does. She does great work. Because you're damn sure not going to get this information. You know, real jaw-dropping stuff, too. What we are willing to slaughter men, women, children, beasts of the field, the unborn babies over in Iran, we will give to the Saudis for free. statement from the White House said that the they call it a deal. I don't know how you can call this a deal. We're giving them stuff, and we're getting nothing out of it. I don't know. Maybe some of George Bush's buddies in the nuclear power industry are getting something out of it. But the deal will pave, this is according to the White House, quote, will pave the way for Saudi Arabia's access to safe, reliable fuel sources for energy reactors. Oh, they're energy reactors now. They're not nuclear reactors. Oh, God, he's got me saying it. They're not nuclear reactors. They're energy reactors. And demonstrate Saudi leadership as a positive non-proliferation model for the region. What in God's name gives them any notion that the Saudis can be trusted with their own little nuclear genie sitting in the bottle on Abdullah's shelf? Because, you know, that whole American cooperation, friends of the Saudis thing, that worked out real good on long about September 10th, 2001. I mean, these are the people, the Saudis, these are the people who put out textbooks in their schools that tell little Saudi children that there will come a day when the very rocks and trees will cry out and say, O son of Allah, O worshiper of Allah, O follower of Muhammad, whatever, come over here to me, for there is a Jew hiding behind me, and you must kill him. Those are the people we're giving the enriched uranium to. Kind of puts a little lump in my throat. The Saudi educational system teaches their students all the way through high school that you, me, and everybody in the world who is not a freakish Wahhabist Muslim, not just Muslim, but you got to be, you know, the Wahhabi brand, that they are all infidels and may be killed if need be. It is the Saudi educational system that teaches children that non-Muslim, non-Saudi, non-Wahhabis are not related to or descended from, but are actually dogs and monkeys. Bless his heart, in the interview, Harvey Wasserman says, you know, I'd like to know the insane asylum in which this policy was concocted. The idea of giving enriched uranium to the Saudis while threatening war with the Iranians for enriching uranium is astonishing. The idea that the Saudis are going to somehow lower the price of oil on the basis of possibly getting nuclear reactors in the future is just almost staggering to think about. Yeah, yeah, Mr. Wasserman, it sure is. That's a heck of an interview. Not very long. Let's see, where does it stand? Yeah, he points out, Mr. Wasserman does, the Saudis do not currently have an operating commercial reactor. If they do build one, it's not going to come from the United States. It'll probably come from France or Japan. And, you know, it's just hard to fathom. It's such an irrational idea that it almost boggles the mind. It makes no sense whatsoever. Circles within circles within circles within circles. I mean, if the Israelis are willing to slaughter Persian people over enriched uranium, this can't be playing very well with them either. But mark my words, Ehud Olmert isn't going to come out and say, ooh, we must bomb the Saudis. Why? Because the Bush family wouldn't like that very much. Because the Bush family is tight with the royal house of Ibn Saud. There is a level of racism inside the saber rattling at the Persian people that is that hasn't been seen in 70 years. It has not, this kind of racism has not been seen in 70 years. And we're participating in it, and the Israelis are participating in it, and precisely no one, with the exception of yours truly, seems to be able to notice the irony of it. So when does it happen? You tell me. Is it a June thing? You know, we had June weddings. Do we also have June Iran bombings? Or maybe would we commemorate our freedom with a July 4th fireworks extravaganza over Tehran? August? It gets kind of slow in Washington in August. Everybody pretty much bugs out. Congress takes a big break. Everybody goes on vacation. Nobody'd be paying attention then. Shoot, even the main news anchors are on vacation then. Fill-in staff, skeleton crews. August looks good. Labor Day? October surprise? Wait a minute. I mean, all these dates have their own little pieces of the puzzle that work for them. But wait, let's assume for a minute that Nancy Capitolosi hasn't actually soiled herself at the thought of John Conyers actually standing up to George Bush. Let's assume that she has not told him that she'll rein him in or punish him in some way if he keeps up this impeachment talk. Just a question. If that's the case, and she doesn't rein in Conyers, what does that mean for the Bush administration bombing Iran? When can they do it? And since the Bush administration, being the sort of low-rent criminals and thugs that they are, they all, you know, the run-up to Iran looks just like the run-up to Iraq. It's the same crap, different day. When might the Bush administration be inclined to light up Iran, understanding that impeachment proceedings have been promised the instant that they do? When? Okay. Let's use former Bush behavior as a prologue. As soon as he knew that he had had his ass handed to him by Bill Clinton, what did George bail out Poppy Bush do? Well, isn't that about the time that he went into Somalia and left Bill Clinton to deal with the mess? Why, yes. Yes, it is. So, I'm guessing, especially if a Democrat wins in November, which I hope will happen, I'm guessing that the Bush administration, not June, not July, not August. August is my second favorite. Not September, not October, not November. But on the way out, George Bush puts his thumb on the end of his nose with his other fingers wagging and goes, "With you and your impeachment, John Conyers, you missed your chance, buddy. The time to impeach me was 4 years ago. And you can impeach all day long. I'm out of here, baby. Light 'em up." And giving that nightmare to the American people for Christmas. That's my take. Let's go to the phones.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, who've I got?
Kevin from Brooklyn.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Nothing much. I hadn't checked in, and I'm kind of on the street, but I heard what you're saying, you know, about the show and all. Yeah, I was wondering, how does this sound to you? I wanted to throw this by you.
Okay.
Those who are such in favor for the war, like those states, in other words, the red states, okay?
Uh-huh.
So we really start throwing those states' rights in their face and say, you know what? Have your National Guard go to Iraq then.
They're already there, aren't they, Kevin?
Yeah, but the blue states pull their troops out.
Well, but the thing is, as far as the National Guards and such are concerned, they're all federalized, and so the states can't pull their National Guard out.
Oh.
They're strictly under the control of the President of the United States as Commander-in-Chief.
Because I thought the National Guard only answered to their governors and stuff like that.
No.
They were federalized.
And you know, for purposes of George Bush's Iraqupation, they are federalized.
Yeah.
But I like idea. But the thing is, I mean, I see December. I mean, it's the perfect Republican screw job on an incoming Democratic president.
Oh, yeah, we're kind of like Somalia.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly like Somalia. And then get somebody to make a movie about the incoming president failing to, not supporting the troops, just like they did with Black Hawk Down.
Yeah.
Yeah, they hung that one on Bill Clinton, even though it was George Bush who sent the troops in inappropriately and ineffectively equipped.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what to say, man. But I just think they're not going to... You know, they're building a bomber out, but around July, August, they're going to do a U-turn on him. They're going to be such a U-turn on him, it's not funny.
How do you mean?
Oh, you know, it's like he's the darling of the media now. But, you know, a little snipe here and there. But he's still pretty much a darling of the media. But come August, remember what I said?
Yeah, the gloves come off.
They're going to check if he double-dipped the chip. They're going to do everything you can think of to bring him down.
Well, because it's all entertainment, it's all sport, and there's nothing serious left in the for-profit media. No, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm kind of pissed off at Bill Clinton for that comment that he said.
Help me out here. Which one?
The one, all these people have college degrees and they all have health insurance and they can all afford death. You know how many college people I know who are working way, way, way below what they studied their degree for?
Oh, I imagine probably a big handful, a whole bunch.
Probably most of us. You know, and people are eating that hook, line, and sinker.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
Why would they?
It's Kentucky. It's one of the least educated states. You know, and I'm sorry to be saying that, but it's true. It's a fact. Kentucky's one of the least educated states in the union.
Well, kind of like West Virginia. Yes, there's truth in that, and no getting around it.
Yeah, and I understand you got to adjust your campaign to each state, but to make a blanket state, even in Kentucky, they can't even fall for that one.
What people will fall for in this country, I've become a wholehearted believer in that old political slogan that you can never go broke underestimating the American people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Anyway, sir, I got to run, but I just want to make it
all right.
Quick.
Sounds like an interesting day out on the streets of Brooklyn, Kevin.
Well, this is Manhattan now.
Oh, well. I don't know if we've ever gotten a call from Manhattan. Hot diggity.
Yeah. All righty.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, then. Good. Bye.
Bye. It would be nice if the blue states, so to speak, could pull their troops. Unfortunately, they can't. They can't. So, what? It's a hell of a way to start the program, and I apologize if I'm just a big old downer. I'll try to do jokes tomorrow. But there's nothing funny in reports. You know, Israeli Army Radio. Okay. I'm guessing they don't do a station ID in Israeli Army Radio without sources. Why would you do that for propaganda purposes? So that it'll go across the border and Hezbollah can dig the trenches a little bit deeper and try to prepare themselves a little bit more? What's the percentage in it? What's the percentage in putting every one of your neighbors on edge? I can't figure it. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Ted Kennedy story. Sending all the warm thoughts that I can manage towards Senator Kennedy and his family. Malignant brain cancer? Ugh. Get well. Get well. Apparently, my senator, Senator Byrd, broke down weeping on the floor of the Senate. When news came to him of Kennedy's illness. He described himself as distraught and terribly shaken. He said, "My thoughts and my humble prayers are with Senator Kennedy, my dear friend Ted, with his wife Vicky, and with the members of the Kennedy family. I hope and pray that an all-caring, omnipotent God will watch over Ted and keep Ted here for us and for America." And that's when he broke down. He said, "Ted, I love you and I miss you, and Irma, my darling wife, would want to say thank God for you, Ted. Thank God for you." You know how I am. I'm hoping Senator Kennedy has an excellent doctor. Because I think an excellent doctor is probably the best hope that Senator Kennedy has. An excellent team of doctors. But Senator Byrd's sentiment is certainly well placed. And yeah, I think we would all do well to be grateful for Senator Kennedy. And you know, I don't know enough about the physics and physiology of the brain to speak to it with any kind of authority. Yeah, Lottie tells me in the chat room he's at Mass General, and that's a fantastic hospital, and darn right it is. It's the teaching hospital for Harvard Medical School, I think, and probably several others. Wow, Lottie. I don't know enough about the physiology of the brain. They said it's a left parietal lobe tumor. But those things don't just happen overnight. And I couldn't help but think, well, first of all, it's my understanding they've had to lock threads over at that filthy swamp, Free Republic, from people getting gleeful about Senator Kennedy's illness. I wouldn't expect anything more of a gang of rabid right-wing thugs like Free Republic. You'll never go broke underestimating the ethics and morals of people who call themselves Americans at Free Republic. But the other thing I thought about is the number of times that the oxymoron, Flush Flemball, America's truth detector, the guy who takes bottles of Viagra on all-boy Dominican Republic vacations, yeah, him, the number of times that he's played sound bites making light of the speech of Senator Kennedy. I don't know if the left parietal lobe has anything to do with the speech center of the brain. I simply don't. But a guy who would sit and jiggle and quake and shake in front of a video camera in mocking a man with Parkinson's disease, well, this is par for the course, isn't it? It turns out, likely, that for quite some time now, Flush Flemball has been mocking a man with a tumor growing inside his brain. Classy bunch, those right-wing gas bags. Sort of like the little comment Keith Olbermann had, last night? Where he said, Laura Ingraham, Mark Levin, not our Mark Levine, Mark Levin, right-wing toady and lickspittle for Flush Flemball. Olbermann said, Laura Ingraham, Mark Levin, why do you hate our troops? And it's true. And $29 million a year goes into the pocket of Flush Flemball so that he can make fun of people who are sick. Although it certainly leads one to wonder who the sicker person is, doesn't it? Because there's no getting around the fact that Flush Flemball is a mighty sick man, but he's sick in his soul, sick in his spirit, sick in his mind. And you know what? There's no cure for any of that. We'll go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I had some good news today.
Yes, ma'am?
I'm out of the clutches of the county.
Hot diggity.
Just made it by the skin of our teeth, too.
But they're off your back.
Yep. Said everything was up to what they wanted.
Well, you know, I guess it was the last time we were talking. I thought I heard a drill working in the background.
Oh,
so
you're liable to hear that. but he, yeah, it was good news. I said, thank God I'm free at last. But if I had a, you know, hadn't have passed this time, I would have automatically had a $750 fine.
Ouch.
Yeah, they kind of month back from the first due date or something. So that's $750 a month.
Lord.
Well, and
but you but you dodged it.
You know, there are worse things.
Although you're hard pressed to figure out what. Yeah, and I never cease to be amazed at these laws and county regulations and ordinances and so forth.
It is really confusing here.
Well, the vast majority of them are seldom used for anybody except people who are hard pressed for the resources to make stuff right.
They're after all. Yeah, I live in kind of, I guess you call a poor middle class. Or poor, but you know, it does seem there's a lot of people they're on to now. But I said, oh God, just I want to get out of this. But I'd like to talk about Senator Kennedy.
Sure, go ahead.
You know what? That guy always stuck up for the little man, no matter what.
Yeah,
the people.
That's what makes the Kennedy family so utterly respectable.
Yeah. You know, the first time I saw, or, you know, listen, I kind of had heard of John Kennedy. And the first time he was on, he was running for president, and he was on the old Jack Parr show. And I listened to him, and I said, I want him for president because he really wanted to help people. And I told one of my neighbors, I said, oh, no, we can't have a Catholic. They'll take over the country. And that kind of shocked me. I wasn't even thinking about anything like that. But anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, it seems like, of course, I know he's lived a pretty good long life, but it seems like the ones that try to help people are the ones that are, you know, least appreciated by the general people or the people who are higher up or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I think I've seen him, like, be on that Washington Journal on C-SPAN.
Right.
And people call in, you know, have a problem, and he said, write their name down, you know, and, you know, you knew he was going to do something for them. You know, you just knew that. But, anyway, Godspeed to him, I say.
Absolutely, and he's, you know, he's got great care, he's got a great facility, and if, you know, if that kind of thing helps your odds, then you got to think that, that Senator Kennedy's odds have been enhanced, and at least, you know, that's my wishful thinking.
Yeah, I also like his son. You know, a lot of people make fun of him, but I never will forget him when he was in the impeachment hearing with you know, for the impeachment of Clinton.
Yeah.
And I never will forget they were referring to his uncle. And I know you remember Bob Barr.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And he told him outside, he said, don't you ever say anything about my uncle. You don't even know him. But he was, I've seen him, you know, with the unions and different things like that. I've seen him different, and I know a lot of people make fun of him, but to me, I admire him.
As do I.
Anyway.
And, you know, Joe Biden today said, if anyone has the grit and determination to beat it, it's Ted. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, what Senator Byrd, his response that I just mentioned a little bit ago was amazing. I mean, listen to this.
Yeah, I missed that.
He's actually in tears right now speaking about Ted Kennedy. Let's listen.
Ted.
What?
Listen.
My dear friend.
Love.
I love you.
This is Senator Byrd, Juanita.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
And I miss you.
Bless
his heart. And Irma, my darling wife, Irma, would want to say thank God for you, Ted. Thank God for you.
Well, we'll have a field day with that, but that's okay. That's par for the course.
Yeah, I'm sure that. Oh, I'm sure that by tomorrow, Rush Limbaugh will be running this over and over again and making light of it. And so will Savage, and so will Bortz, and so will O'Reilly, and so will the whole sick right wing crowd.
And you know, people bring up about him being a member of the Klan. He didn't hide it.
No.
And another thing, if Bush was an alcoholic till he became a Christian, I guess he became a Christian, that's what they say. If he can change, why can't anybody else change? I mean,
well, no, that's a case of I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. It's okay if you're a Republican.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was telling my son about Huckabee and, you know, his latest offense, and Obama's latest offense of saying sweetie. What a difference.
Oh, the things that catch this country's attention.
You know, he's good at that. You know, he's one of those, you know how some preachers are, you know that.
Sure.
They got the gift of gab sometime.
That's true, they do.
Okay, well, I'll let you go, Bob, and you have a nice evening.
Oh, I'm so glad you've got the bureaucratic...
Well, giving me a listening ear, that helped, you know? It really did.
Well, I hope so. I hope so, Anita.
It was a rough business, I'll tell you, going through, but I said, you know, there are worse things.
Well, that's... Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
That's the way you have to look at it.
Absolutely.
A whole lot worse things.
All right. Well, Juanita, you have a good evening, and congratulations, and
Thank you.
Celebrate a little bit, take a breather, and I know your son has worked awfully hard.
He sure has.
And he is to be commended for that.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
He is. You done a good job, Juanita.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You take care.
Good
Bye
night.
Now. That's sad and touching, Senator Byrd's remarks. And I have no doubt of the sincerity of them. My differences with Senator Byrd are political and philosophical. Not anything but. So, but make no mistake, it will be made great fun of by Flush Flimball by this time tomorrow, because they're just that soulless, and they are that kind. They're that kind of monsters. So, that's our first hour. And your calls are always welcome. I've seen a lot of responses on the internet today to the news about Senator Kennedy. If you want to sound off about that, feel free, because it's certainly understandable. Among other things, he showed tremendous courage just entering public life. And if anybody, oh, brother, the heartbreak, and the courage. So, get well soon, Senator Kennedy. Get well soon. This is The Horn.
Brought up from the grave. It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Here we go. Sometimes my jockeying skills are less than what they ought to be. Hey, look, you see a song called Get Well Soon, you know, you think. Yeah. But, yeah, not this time. Love Steve Forbert, but that wasn't the song for the situation. Email rolling in from our pal Cindy in the Great Northwest. How could Rush Limbaugh make fun of someone with a brain tumor? Didn't he get out of Vietnam because of a tumor on his ass? And isn't his own brain up there, too? All true. All true. But you gotta realize, when you're dealing with the right wing, you're dealing with some truly classless, sick, twisted monsters. I mean, hell, we spent the first hour talking about this lunacy of attacking Iran. It comes from the same minds. It comes from the same brains. The same lame brains. You know, I right wingers? No. I share nothing in common with them. I don't even consider them my fellow countrymen, because they're, you know, the people who advance the stuff that right wingers want out of this world, they're not Americans. They certainly don't have the love of country that liberals and progressives and people like you and I do. On the other hand, like I said, these are some sick people. So what do you get from Ken Timmerman, right-wing freak? Headline, Iranians would welcome being bombed. No, really, actually what the headline says is, Iranians would welcome airstrikes, sources say. Sources. Yeah, you know, sources. Some madman under a bridge somewhere in Iran. Oh yeah, that'll be all right by me. As Barack Obama and John McCain thrash it out over how they would deal with Iran, voices from inside Iran are weighing in with an unusual message. If the United States strikes hard and fast, we will support you. Gee, I wonder if they'll greet us as liberators, too. Emissaries from inside Iran have been meeting with Iranian exiles in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere in recent weeks to deliver this provocative message, which they claim comes from pro-U.S. dissidents at the uppermost levels of the regime. Oh, God, curveballs on the loose again, huh? And this time he's speaking Farsi. U.S. airstrikes must be powerful and sustained enough to break the myth of the regime's absolute power and reveal the weakness of the leadership, a former official who traveled outside of Iran recently said. But Ken Timmerman can't give him a name. Yeah, he wants us to target the office of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Yeah, as well as the headquarters of the Revolutionary Guards Corps. The offices of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Bart Cop came up with that, and I just love it. And that of his predecessor and rival, Mullah Hashemi Rafsanjani. They want 48 to 72 hours of uninterrupted bombing that would decapitate the regime. Oh, that's charming. Wait, I thought it was only the crazy Muslims who did all the decapitating. Oh, dear. Such a strike would send a clear message to the Iranian people. I'll bet! Yeah, that'd sure win the hearts and minds. Because we have precision weapons, right? Precision weapons. I mean, we can drop a 1,000-pound bomb on the head of a pin, right? I mean, we're just that good. Or so we're told. I mean, we've got rock solid, undeniably awesome weapons. Except when we don't. This story out of Florida. Headline, Navy bomb misses by mile, starts woods fire, laser-guided bomb detonates in Ocala Forest. It's from last week. There's a reason you hang on to stories like this. During what was supposed to be a routine training exercise, God, that was, wasn't that how that documentary about the Bermuda Triangle? Three Navy flyers on a routine training exercise disappeared in 1946 over the Bermuda Triangle. Okay, so, yeah. During what was supposed to be a routine training exercise, a bomb landed off target, landing and igniting a fire in the Ocala National Forest last week. The 500-pound laser-guided bomb was dropped by an F-A-18 Super Hornet a week ago and detonated about a mile east of the Pine Castle target range. Missed it by that much! The near-miss... The near-miss burned about 250 acres of forest and swampland. The Bush administration and the Pentagon are so good that with their near misses, they actually burn swamps. Man, that's some. That's a talent. The information came from a fire management officer with the U.S. Forest Service. The jet that dropped the near miss laser guided precision bomb was from Strike Fighter Squadron 213, based out of NAS Oceana in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Well, we fly all the way from Virginia Beach to bomb Florida. Iran's a no-brainer. The Navy said the event is, and you know, try not to chuckle, under investigation. So the same gang that drops laser-guided pinpoint precision bombs on the Ocala National Forest is the gang that we're going to expect to drop precision pinpoint laser-guided bombs only on bad people in Iran. No babies. No little old men. No pregnant mamas. They're only going to hit the bad people because these are laser-guided precision bombs. They don't miss much. Often. Hardly ever. Sorta. Kinda. Let's see. Mohibat Adia is an Iranian media analyst at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and he said the conventional wisdom is that limited strikes will allow the regime to rally the people around the flag. However, if the U.S. launches a major strike that goes after the leadership in Iran, that's different. Most Iranians hate the regime. People would be very happy to see a major strike that took out the leadership. I've heard this before. I mean, isn't this we would be welcomed as liberators all over again? That's mission accomplished, bring them on, you know, wanted dead or alive, all of that silly garbage. But this is the, you know, this is the run-up. This is the sales job. This is how we did Iraq, and this is how we're going to do Iran. And I don't know. Go to the headonradionetwork.com chat room. Maybe we'll get a pool started. I've got December, remember. Try to remember that I've got December, and that's when the bombs will fall. I got December. If you're not already in there, I guess you're gonna have to get stuck with something else. But I've got December. I've got early December. Okay, to make more spaces on the little board, I've got the first 2 weeks of December. Okay, that leaves everything else for anybody else. But I invented the game. So first 2 weeks of December. Although, wait a minute. Poppy Bush invaded Panama on Christmas Day. Wow. Yeah, you don't have to pick a particular day. Just to, you know, sort of like first week of, first 2 weeks of. I got first 2 weeks of December. Okay, we've got an October 10th, an October 31st, August 16th. I hope somebody's writing all this down. I don't know what we'll do for a prize. I don't see how there could be a prize with something like this. It's just more going to be more like, I don't know, maybe a little trophy that says amateur psychologist, able to diagnose psychotics at a distance. Well, you know, hell, Bill Frist was diagnosing a brain dead woman on videotape. If we can't look at the evidence and predict when George Bush will make the bombs fall on, you know, children, women, old folks, you know, in Iran, you know, with those laser guided bombs that are in the pinpoint accuracy, except when they're not, well, what can we do? So there's a starting place. Now, if you want to, I'll tell you what, if you want to send this stuff in via email, I'll enter you just for the purposes of keeping track of who's got what. Bob@headonradio.com. I'll take your bets. They're not bets. I mean, you know what I mean. Your predictions. Because there ain't no prize. But, yeah. Oh, let's see. For some reason, everything today is creepy. There's just not a lot of... Okay, I'll save that for the end of the program. By the way, while you're out there worrying about how you're going to buy the next tank of gas, you might be pleased to know that the Federal Reserve has auctioned off another $75 billion in loans to banks. Mm-hmm. The total so far of the bank welfare program is $510 billion since December. Today, the Federal Reserve came out and announced the results of its most recent auction, the 12th, again, since December. And commercial banks paid an interest rate of 2.100% for the short-term loans. There were 75 bidders for the slice of the $75 billion in 28-day loans. There were bids for $84.4 billion worth of loans. The auction took place yesterday. You know, I usually read the special notices section of the little county paper, and I didn't see it. Otherwise, I would have gone and... you know, maybe they would have had a little itty-bitty loan that I could have bid on. Kind of like when you go to an auction and they're selling, you know, the great big wingback Chesterfield chairs and the partner desks and stuff like that, and you come in, well, maybe I can get a candlestick. Maybe we could have got a candlestick. You know, working America. This auction program was created last December out of thin air in order to give banks a new way to get short-term loans from the central bank to help them over the credit hump. The credit hump that, yeah, working people created that credit hump. No, they didn't. The banking industry, the securities industry, the hustlers created the credit hump. What hump? But that's okay. You and I pay for it. Sure we do. Is it just me, or the last time that someone mentioned the idea of helping the people who are trapped? Didn't I hear this on Mark Levine's show? Helping out people who are trapped and tormented in their subprime loans. The last time that was mentioned in Congress, didn't the right wing and the Repig Lickens and George Bush and that whole filthy crowd have an absolute just fit? Oh, we can't reward irresponsible borrowers. Oh. I guess irresponsible borrowers are by definition only people who work for a living. And the article I'm looking at from the Associated Press indicates that there will be more of these taxpayer-sponsored little auctions, loan auctions. The Federal Reserve is expected to focus more on these and other efforts to help banks and investment. Oh, and investment firms! How nice! They got invited to the party, too. To help banks and investment firms overcome any credit problems as it winds down an aggressive rate-cutting campaign that started last September. Oh, it's winding down, okay. But the auction thing isn't, just the rate-cutting. And it's winding down because we've run out of rates to cut, you understand. I mean, if you think of it in terms of a sheaf of wheat or a stalk of corn, the Fed has gone in and cut it down to about an inch above the dirt. The interest rate at this point is 2%. That's for the, you know, for the hoity-toity types. No, don't get you don't get any 2% loans, okay? No. What are you thinking? Your credit cards are still at 23.9%, sunshine, and it ain't coming down. The Fed is hoping. I like it when the experts hope. Maybe they're hoping and believing. The Fed is hoping that its powerful rate cuts, along with the stimulus package, will help lift the economy out of its funk in the second half of the year. How about that? We're not in a recession. We're in a funk. Oh, damn. Baseball game was rained out. I'll have to stay home now. I'm in a funk. I want to be a professional writer for the Associated Press. You can get away with calling a recession a funk. That's like stealing. That's like free money. It's a funk. Yeah, people getting thrown out of their homes, they're getting thrown out of their homes because the economy's in a funk. Can't beat that. How much more do we have to do to carry the hummingbird canopy crowd? How much more do we have to do for them? I mean, I'm just asking. Now we're holding auctions for them? What next, working America? Bake sales? We're having a bake sale for the Bear Stearns investment bankers. We hear that they may have to sell some of their mansions, so we're hoping you'll buy a chocolate chip cookie today. We're having the bake sale because the economy's in a funk. It's sort of like a 13-year-old who's gone up to its room to pout. It's in a funk. How much more disrespect can one tender to the American middle class and working class. $4 a gallon gas on the way to $5. $5 a gallon gas on the way to $6. People making choices between food and fuel. People letting their debts go to the wayside because their wages aren't going up along with everything else that is. And there's a writer for the Associated Press spitting in their face, telling them that the economy is in a funk. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's funky. Yeah, that's funky. Yeah, that's funky. That sounds like funk. It must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. Singing, stinking stuff. That sounds like funk. It must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. Singing, stinking stuff. If it sounds like funk, it must be us. Cause nobody's funky as us. Cause we keep it stinking. We keep it stinking. We keep it stinking. We keep it stinking. Stinking, stinking, stinking.
Under all funk like you headlock in a skunk. Reeking like disease after you speak. The stench didn't come till after this beat. Smelling like draws, no reason, no pause. Put your hands up on the speaker, get smelly as paws. You knew we was coming before we entered the door. Cause you could smell the rhyme when we was walking down the hall. We bring the funk worse than a wet dog. Thinking like fat lady shitting out long. We dropping up shit and keep the toilets clogged. Keep the people jumping like them bullfrogs. The first one that smells, it ain't the one who built it. Black eyed peas keep the scent flying like Delta. Bumpy like onions, you crying. Girl, you ain't lying.
If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. Singing, stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. Singing, stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. Singing, stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. Cause nobody's funny as us. Cause we keep it stinking. We keep it stinking. We keep it stinking. We keep it stinking.
Family, the non-fabricated factual faculty. We formulating up in the factory, focusing on the energy, the fluid flow free. We flawless, everything is fall free. We flourish and we flaunt our flavor freshly. We believe we flip through frequencies and bring them seeds, they leave all frantically. But our intentions ought to be friendly. But they fighting when we start the freestyling frenzy. I funk up your flat to your girlfriend, me filling our anatomy, bringing me flattery. Should be digging these rhymes, bad knees, beats like say a light, lyrics all flabby. We bring the funk to your festivities. If you think something's stank, then it must be the pee.
If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. It is stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. It is stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. The funk, funk, tall bells. It is stinking stuff. If it smells like funk, it must be us. Cause nobody's funny as us. Cause we keep this stinking.
Stankin' MCs that smell so strong, it's unsanitary. Cause you can sense me a mile away, so janky. With the jungle funk sound from Serengeti. Meaty fat nasty like Miss Fat Booty's tights. Getting dirty like mud fights and dirt fights. Turning these drawers black that used to be white. And we shitting on these tracks that you gonna need to wipe. The odor's so contagious that it shows up in your dream. And you can pick me out like food in between your two front teeth. Cause you be like in the streets. We got beefy ass beasts that be bumping in the streets. You're salty not sweet like stick box beat. Sour underarm funk you ain't washed in a weekend. Man, we be weekend every damn weekend. We could all couch the funk in the season.
Funky. If you smell that stuff of funky, then you know it gotta be nobody other than Apple will let you move. Cause you know that if it smells like funk, then it must be us.
just so happy and upbeat, isn't it? I mean, you can almost see you can almost see the little investment bankers from Bear Stearns just kind of bumping to the funk and sitting there. Yeah, I'll bid. Yeah, again, going. Oh, I won. Hey, I won again. Look at that. Look at them old working people providing welfare for me. Yeah, that's some funk. Ooh. Just ooh. When you sit back, yeah, you want to talk about real elitism. When you think about how our betters in the Bear Stearnses and the Morgan Stanleys of the world and the Goldman Sachses of the world think about working America and what we do for them, man, don't you know they had to, you want to talk about elitism, there's your elitism. Because that's a laugh riot. We are the biggest joke on the planet to the moneyed class, who are largely, after all, Republicans. Busting our asses day in and day out. Carrying an entire country on our backs. So that the investment banks, investment houses, can go to an auction and buy up some cheap money that we, by God, printed and don't get any of. Because we've got to keep the economy going, and the economy is run by Bear Stearns and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, see, that's the big fraud. You run the economy. The CEO of Goldman Sachs, he doesn't do a damned thing. He doesn't make anything. You can't buy anything from him. He can't sell you a blanket to keep you from freezing to death in the winter or a fan to keep you cool in the summer. He shuffles paper. Now it's not even paper he shuffles anymore. He just shuffles electrons. You, baby, you, however, you get up and you go to work every day, and I don't want to hear any complaints. We don't like belly achers around here. What do you mean your car's broke down? What do you mean you need $2,000 for a new transmission? What do I look like, a money tree? You get to work or I'll find somebody else that will instead. Shut up and get to your cubicle. That's America. Hot diggity. Yeah, Albuquerque's atheist, Rick, says put me down for October 27th, 7:32 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Will it still be daylight time then? Won't we have gone to standard by then? Wow, do I get lost in the details. He says, thanks for the sanity. Thank you for keeping me sane. But that's about right. 7:32 p.m., that would be perfect for the evening news. Right there on top of, you know, with enough lead time for all the talking heads to talk about how we're going to have regime change and be greeted as liberators. And then the fireworks show starts. You know, you always got to have the patriotic music and the talk and the run-up and people milling around in anticipation, waiting for the light show to start. 7:30 is about the right time. I mean, you know, you don't want to do it at 3 in the morning or anything. How many hours ahead of us? 9.5 hours? 9, 10 hours? Iran? So, let's... 6... Yeah, we'd do it under the cover of darkness. We'd do it in the dark and still of the night. You know, like a burglar, like a cut purse, like a foot pad, like a sneak thief, we'd do it under the dark cover of darkness. So that the people we slaughter will be killed in their sleep. Never know what hit them. Just a loud, and then boom. Everybody go bye-bye. But if it... Sorry. Sorry. But that's what we're looking at. Just is. Got an email in from our buddy Mara. Headline, is the government compiling a secret list of citizens to detain under martial law? Subject line in her email said that this should scare every citizen. And I read it before the program started. And it scared me. What is at issue is a plan that has been alleged to be in existence within the Bush administration. And rather than sit here and confuse things by getting all stream of consciousness on it, let me just share with you what I've got in front of me. Last year, former Deputy Attorney General James Comey revealed that in 2004 he refused to certify the legality of certain aspects of the National Security Agency spy program. You remember this. This is when Comey testified about how he watched Alberto Gonzalez, Torture Boy, and Andy Card as they tried to compel John Ashcroft, who was laying in a hospital bed in misery. No, not Missouri, misery. I think it was pancreatitis he had. Tried to arm twist him into approving the program that Comey had balked at. Now, Comey did not give any details, and everybody sort of scratched their little heads and said, what was it he didn't want to certify? What is this? Well, back then, Peter Swire of the Center for American Progress wrote that what Comey was implying was that other programs existed for domestic spying outside of the NSA program and about which we know nothing. Well, now there's an article out, and this is the article that Maura sent me from a writer by the name of Christopher Ketchum at Radar Magazine that gets a little bit more up close and personal in terms of describing what that other program is. The May-June issue of Radar Magazine. And what he says, what he asks is, are you on the list? The federal government has been developing a highly classified plan that will override the Constitution in the event of a major terrorist attack. See, language like this is bothersome to me, because it leaves something like major in major terrorist attack to be defined by the people who benefit from defining something as a major terrorist attack. And Christopher Ketchum also references James Comey's testimony. And he identifies something called the Continuity of Governance Program. He says that the Continuity of Governance Program encompasses national emergency plans that would trigger the takeover of the country by extra-constitutional forces. Jiminy. Extra-constitutional forces. Isn't that just several syllables more than we need to say fascist thugs? Ketchum reports that it's a roadmap for martial law. He said, Comey refused to knuckle under, and the dispute came to a head on the cold night of March 10th, 2004, hours before the program's authorization was to expire. At the time, Ashcroft was in intensive care at George Washington Hospital following emergency surgery. He says, apparently at the behest of George Bush himself, the White House tried, in Comey's words, quote, to take advantage of a very sick man, sending, as I've noted, Andy Card and torture boy Gonzalez to arm twist John Ashcroft into signing off on the plan. Ashcroft wouldn't sign. He said, I'm not the Attorney General. He was heavily medicated and had, you know, temporarily handed over power to James Comey. He said, I'm not the Attorney General. And he pointed at Comey, there is the Attorney General. And Gonzalez and Card both got purple in the face with anger and wouldn't even acknowledge Comey's presence in the room. And the following day, without Comey's signature or the signature of anyone from the Department of Justice attesting to its legality, the plan went forward. And we don't know to this day what that plan was, but Ketchum notes that 2 months after Comey's testimony to Congress, the New York Times reported a tantalizing detail. The program that prompted him, quote, to threaten resignation involved computer searches through massive electronic databases. You know, I said, I saw a posting at a website earlier today saying, you know, will you people who keep talking about martial law just shut up? There's no way Bush could possibly get away with that. You're being irrational. And I just thought, oh, Buster, you don't get it. It's not that we're not being rational. Those SOBs in the Bush administration haven't had a rational moment in their miserable, insane, psychotic, psychopathic lives. It's not our rationality you gotta worry about. But that was just a little hint. Massive computer searches through massive electronic databases. The New York Times article said, quote, it is not known precisely why searching the databases or data mining raised such a furious legal debate. Oh, this article's a long one. But if you go to thinkprogress.org, you can link to it. It links to the story. Ketchum notes that very few people, professional journalists or anyone else, know a blessed thing about the continuity of government program. So that nobody's pink little ears perk up at the mention of it. Comey is remaining mum. He left DOJ in 2005. Now, on the other hand, a number of former governmental employees, Ketchum reports, and intelligence sources with independent knowledge of domestic surveillance operations claim the program that caused the flap between Comey and the White House related to a database of Americans who might be considered potential threats in the event of a national emergency. Sources familiar with the program, Ketchum says, claim that the government's data gathering has been overzealous and probably conducted in violation of federal law and the protection from unreasonable search and seizure guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment. Why am I suddenly thinking about Nancy Capitolosi? Why am I thinking about telecom immunity? Who would have helped in all of this? Who would have helped in the data gathering? We know from lawsuits that were extant that the major telecoms and the major internet service providers have been more than complicit. They've been more than collaborators. They have been enablers of these government unconstitutional, un-American government schemes. Because, you know, a number of times I've heard Mark Levine say, you know, listen, the telecoms are protected under the law of the United States as it stands. They don't need special retroactive immunity. They don't need congressionally conveyed immunity. And he makes a compelling case for it. Unless the primary purpose for granting this immunity would be to make sure that something like this couldn't possibly come to light during the discovery phase of a lawsuit. If you've been listening to this program for any period of time at all by now, you know how grounded in reality I am. My feet are practically nailed into the dirt. I'm so grounded into reality. I don't buy into magic cookies or magic wine. I don't buy into faith-based anything. I don't like speculation. I don't like stuff that doesn't have any evidence behind it. And yet I read a story like this and I get a case of the creeps in the pit of my stomach that just turns my bowels to water. Ketchum writes, according to a senior government official who served with high-level security clearances in five administrations, quote, there exists a database of Americans who, often for the slightest and most trivial reason, are considered unfriendly and who, in a time of panic, might be incarcerated. The database can identify and locate perceived enemies of the state almost instantaneously. The database is sometimes referred to by the code name Main Core. One knowledgeable source tells Ketchum that the database has the names of 8 million Americans in Main Core listed as potentially suspect. In the event of a national emergency, these people could be subject to everything from heightened surveillance and tracking to direct questioning and possibly even detention. Doesn't make me feel real good. Doesn't. Because you and I, we, love the Constitution of the United States to a point of devotion that is something nigh to religious. For me, it's the closest thing I have to a religious experience, my regard for the Constitution. When I consider the blood that has been shed, not just by mine and my family, my forebears, my ancestors, but by everyone in this country to preserve it. Yeah, it is. It's a religious devotion. Because those people were the saviors of our secular society. designed that way and implemented that way. Now, he goes on and writes, in the case of a wide-scale attack, the executive branch becomes the sole and absolute seat of authority. The country becomes, within a matter of hours, a police state. Interestingly, plans drawn up during the Reagan administration suggest this parallel government would be ruling under authority given by law to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Oh, God, the heck of a job, Brownie people. Under a national emergency, FEMA and its parent organization, the Department of Homeland Security, would be empowered to seize private and public property, all forms of transport, all food supplies. The agency could dispatch military commanders to run state and local governments. It could order the arrest of citizens without a warrant, holding them without trial, and, hey, look, without access to habeas corpus. Wonder how that got in there. For as long as the acting government deems necessary. In a word, it could put Americans, American citizens, in concentration camps. And it's not some sort of wild left-wing conspiracy theory that the camps are built or in the building. In Texas, among other places, we have incarcerated little children in places like the Tidanhutto Detention Center. The Tidanhutto concentration camp. During the Iceman raid last week in Postville, Iowa, people were rounded up and sent to a cattle yard, and their children were left to wonder where mommy was, or daddy. In other areas nearby in Iowa, people who were of so-called questionable employability documentation were calling in all over the place saying, is it safe to go to work? Because without warrants and without probable cause, without anything resembling judicial review of their actions, the Icemen descended upon those poor workers in Iowa, rounded them up, and hauled them off. There is some speculation in this article, and like I said, I don't care for speculation. Ketchum does say that another well-informed source, a former military operative regularly briefed by members of the intelligence community, says this particular program has roots going back at least to the 1980s and was set up with help from the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's been told that the program utilizes software that makes predictive judgments of targets' behavior and tracks their circle of associations with social network analysis and artificial intelligence modeling tools. The more data you have on a particular target, the better the software can predict what the target will do, where the target will go, who it will turn to for help. Main Core is the table of contents for all the illegal information that the U.S. government has compiled on specific targets. Ketchum says an intelligence expert who has been briefed by high-level contacts in the Department of Homeland Security confirms that a database of this sort exists, but adds that it's less a mega database than a way to search numerous other agency databases at the same time. Oh, okay. You don't believe any of this? You sure? You remember the early days of the first go-round of the Bush administration? When George tried to insinuate Admiral William Poindexter, that old filthy Iran-Contra crook, into his administration, and they talked about a program they called Total Information Awareness. Not made-up stuff, not conspiracy stuff. No, no, no. Real reported news. Total Information Awareness. And it was going to be a database, wasn't it? And it was going to be a database that was the mother of all databases. And they got caught and said, okay, we won't do that since you caught us. All right, that's fine. We're going to have to stop now. And as soon as all the lights and the cameras and the microphones went away, they said, oh, good thing we had our fingers crossed. Mr. Ketchum has done a pretty good job of pulling together little snippets here and there that point to a terribly, terribly frightening future. He says, in March, a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal shed further light onto the extraordinarily invasive scope of the NSA efforts. According to the journal, the government can now electronically monitor huge volumes of records of domestic emails and internet searches, as well as bank transfers, credit card transactions, travel, and telephone records. Authorities employ sophisticated software programs to sift through the data, searching for suspicious patterns. Oh, geez, it's straight out of A Beautiful Mind. Somewhere in the bowels of the NSA, some freak is cutting clippings out of highlights for children trying to find the terrorists. Horses' asses. That means you, Agent Fred. An American punk. The following information seems to be fair game for collection without a warrant. The email addresses you send to and receive from, the subject lines of those messages, the phone numbers you dial, the numbers that dial into your line, and the durations of the calls, the internet sites you visit, and the keywords in your web searches, the destinations of the airline tickets you buy, the amounts and locations of your ATM withdrawals, and the goods and services you purchase on credit cards. All of this information is archived on government supercomputers and, according to sources, also fed into the main core database. I don't know if you were listening to the horn section last night, but we talked a little bit about Genocide Joe Lieberman and his letter telling YouTube how to run its business. And telling YouTube what kind of information, you know, and via YouTube, Google, what kind of information Americans should be allowed to see. Little pieces, little circles within circles. Main Core also draws on four smaller databases that also cull from federal, state, and local intelligence reports, print and broadcast media, financial records, commercial databases, and unidentified private sector entities. Unidentified private sector entities. Hold on. Time out. You know that law that says that the government can't do any of this? That's rather unequivocal in saying that the government can't do any of this. Well, we know for a fact, it's documentable, that the Bush administration and the thugs therein, who are the consummate seekers of loopholes, made the stunning legal judgment that the law says the government can't do it, but what that means is the government has to contract it out to have it done. Anybody remember the name of that outfit in Atlanta, Georgia, that data mines and did data mine and got caught data mining, did the data mining for the Florida 2000 election? Anybody remember the word choice point? Now, what's that? Culls from print and broadcast media, financial records, commercial databases, and unidentified private sector entities. That's where you sub in the word choice point. That's where you sub in the word TransUnion. Yeah. Then there's the Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment, TIDE, Tide. It generates watch lists from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence for use by airlines, law enforcement, border posts. The Washington Post says that Tide has quadrupled in size between 2003 and 2007. It includes now about 435,000 names. Then there's the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center Border Crossing List. It has 755,000 people in it as of the fall of 2007, and it grows by 200,000 names a year. The Treasury Department maintains the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. That's an electronic funds transfer surveillance program. It contributes data to Maine Corps as well. And then there's the Pentagon program that was created in 2002 to monitor anti-war protesters, you know, Quakers, the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh. It monitors the vegans who protest out in front of Heavenly Hams, for the love of God. It also monitors people like Greenpeace. Guess what? It also monitors people who oppose mountaintop removal. Got the chills yet? Got the creeps yet? Ketchum says, from your late night emails and travel plans to phone records and financial transactions, the government finds you fascinating and may consider you a potential enemy of the state. The Maine Corps database includes dissidents and activists of various stripes, political and tax protesters, lawyers and professors, publishers and journalists, gun owners. Oh, no, not the gun owners. They're good, law-abiding Americans. That's why they're members of the National Republican Rifle Association. But like I said, when, you know, Agent Fred or Dick or whatever shows up in his all dark suit with skinny lapels and a skinny tie, a thing in his ear and no sense of humor, and I'm a citizen, I need your gun. Okay, I'm a good NRA member and I voted Republican all my life. That means I get to keep my guns, right? No, citizen, we need your guns now. Well, what about my Second Amendment right to keep and arm bears? Citizen, I will not ask you for your guns again. Give us your guns now, citizen. Okay, here, you can have my guns. Don't pry them from my cold, dead fingers or nothing, because I was only kidding about that stuff. That cold, dead fingers business. I don't want my fingers to be cold or dead, okay? Thank you, citizen. Keep your head down. Comply. Face the flag. And God bless America.
God bless America. You want me to say the Pledge of Allegiance, Agent? I can do that, too.
This is sweaty stuff. He says later in the article, the Miami Herald contacted or contended that Reagan loyalist Oliver North had spearheaded the development of a secret contingency plan. 10 years later, a new round of government martial law plans came to light, and a report in the Miami Herald contended that Reagan loyalist and Iran-Contra conspirator Colonel Ollie North had spearheaded the development of a secret contingency plan codenamed Rex 84. Here, Rex! Here, Rex! Come here, boy! Get the information, get the dissidents, get the un-American bastards, that's right, the ones on the Democratic registration rolls. Get them, Rex! Go, boy! Go! The North Plan called for the detention of upwards of 400,000 illegal aliens and an undisclosed number of American citizens in at least 10 military facilities maintained as potential holding camps. Yeah. This goes on and on and on. and is not conducive to a good night's sleep. You'd kind of like to print this off and stand in front of Nancy Capitulosi and read the whole damn thing to her, and then just drop it in front of her and say, "Madam, this is all on the table. Why isn't impeachment? Why do the American people not deserve? Why do the American people not deserve your best efforts in fulfilling your oath?
Not to the Commander-in-Chief, not to the President, not to the flag,
but to the Constitution of the United States of America, which declares unequivocally that every last bit of the garbage detailed in this report, Madam Speaker, is unconstitutional and downright treasonous." Why not, Madam? And then, you know how horror movies, at the end it shows, you know, the little hand that you thought, the monster, the killer, whatever, the little hand that you thought was dead kind of coming around the corner of the door or whatever, or coming up through the water, you know, with that arm like Deliverance or whatever, sort of hinting at a potential sequel. Well, at the end of this article, it says, "Update, since this article went to press, several documents have emerged to suggest the story has longer legs than we thought. Most troubling among these is an October 2001 Justice Department memo that detailed the extra-constitutional powers of the U.S. military might invoke during domestic operations following a terrorist attack. In the memo, John Yoo," Mark Levine's old Yale Law School classmate, not that they were buddies or anything, I don't think Mark would pee on John Yoo if John Yoo was blazing the flame. John Yoo, then Deputy Assistant Attorney General, concluded that, this is a quote, "concluded that the Fourth Amendment had no application to domestic military operations." Kind of like to have a little chat with the Dean of the Yale School of Law and find out how that little fascist bastard ever got out of there with a law school degree. He concluded that the Fourth Amendment has no application to domestic military operations. Let me scratch my empty little head for a minute here and see if I can... there's something in that Bill of Rights about not quartering troops in citizens' homes. If the framers of the Constitution took the time to create an amendment that said you'll not be quartering any troops inside citizens' homes, then don't you think they thought about the other things that the Redcoats had done to them over the course of the Revolution? The military operations that had been perpetrated against citizenry during the time of the Rebellion? See, that's the problem I keep pointing to, is that these people, they can't see the forest for the trees. They're so smart, they're stupid. Or maybe they're just so stupid, they're stupid. That's what I opt for. I personally think that John Yoo gets up in the morning and has to wear loafers because he's baffled by shoelaces. It has no application to military operations. Now, we're talking here about these people who like to call themselves, what, strict constructionists, right? Here, let's just check out the text of the Fourth Amendment real quick, just for the fun of it. See, I can make computer noises during the show because this is a computer-based internet program. And that's sort of the whole multimedia experience, so pardon the clackety-clacks, will ya? Yeah, here's the text of the Fourth Amendment. This is what John Yoo says has no applicability to military operations inside the United States. "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched or the persons or things to be seized." Now, call me crazy, but I didn't see anything in there as I read it. And, you know, you can use the Google, too, and go read the text of it for yourself. I didn't see anything in there about, except in times of military operations inside the territorial United States. Now, did you, or do you, did you hear it? This is all pretty doggone unambiguous language. Shall not be violated. Not may not be violated except in case of insurrection. Shall not be violated. No warrants shall issue. Well, see, but we're doing all this stuff without a warrant, so that means that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. Oh! Idiots! Because you can hear the fat Tony Scalia, that ugly fascist, even now you can hear him. Well, I'm a strict constructionist, and there's nothing in the document that says that George Bush can't have a database of everywhere that everybody goes on the Internet, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the federal government can't pay companies to data mine the citizens, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says we can't use supercomputers to using artificial intelligence to pull all that stuff together and predict where you're going to go, even though we don't have a grudge against you or you're not suspected of any crimes or anything. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we can't do that. Case closed. And that is how freedom dies in America. In the October 2001 memo that you authored, he refers to a classified DOJ document titled Authority for Use of Military Force to Combat Terrorist Activities Within the United States. The Associated Press reports that, quote, exactly what domestic military action was covered by the October memo is unclear, but federal documents indicate that the memo relates to the National Security Agency's terrorist surveillance program. Last month, Attorney General John Mukasey refused to clarify before Congress whether the U memo was still in force. Meanwhile, Congressman Peter DeFazio has apparently abandoned his effort to get to the bottom of the White House COG classified annexes, continuation of governance. DeFazio's chief of staff is Penny Dodge. She says that's not so. She says, quote, we will be sending a letter requesting a classified briefing soon. Oh, good. We're going to send them a letter. That'll shake them up. That'll rattle them. George Bush will lose sleep. Going to get a letter? Yeah, they're going to get a letter. It's about 10 minutes past the hour. What do you think? Too stunned to discuss this? Are you under the impression that you're not on a database somewhere? At what point in time do the American people say enough is enough? Do we have to wait until American Idol gets turned off? If we stop dancing with the stars, will the American people sit up and take notice? Wait a minute! I don't feel so free anymore. American Idol ain't on. I used to have the freedom to watch American Idol. Yeah, I'm being a hillbilly elitist right now. I honest to God am. Actually, what I think I'm actually being is patriotic. Yeah. So a little break, and then we come back. You want to get in on the conversation? You know how. 877-443-2366. Oh, slow down, Bob. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel. 304-658-3333. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Fathers, they had pride. It wasn't perfect, they fought and died. 200 years of struggle for equality. Now we look more like a monarchy. The halls where justice did once reside has been sold out and replaced with lies. It's all money, power to the few. How long until they come for you? And you say that it can never happen here. And you say it can never happen here. Burn habeas corpus, tear up the writs, rubber stamps, Senator hypocrites. Those new detention camps weren't built for show. Posse comitatus is next to go. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say that it can never happen here.
Another reminder, just for those of you keeping score at home, Peter Godbold will not join us for a live Strictly Confidential here in about 45 minutes. He is deep in the bowels of the most recalcitrant server, trying to make it calcitrant, I guess. I don't know. Maybe somebody like Eugene Finnerman could help me with that. Is calcitrant a word? I don't know. So, you know, but you know what? By mentioning that, I know I'll find out. It'll probably be a topic of your RDA of irony sometime in the next couple of days. calcitrant? Is that what you got when you got kidney stones? No, that's calcifications. Never mind. Are you... I don't remember spending that much time on a story in quite a while because there was so much detail to it. And I know that it gave me the creeps. Just remember that phrase, COG. Remember that acronym, COG, Continuity of Governance. Bruce Fein, who was a Reagan administration lawyer, said, "We are at the edge of a cliff and we're about to fall off. To a national emergency planner, everybody looks like a danger to stability." Tough to stomach. Mighty, mighty tough to stomach. Meanwhile, NBC News is projecting that Senator Hillary Clinton, will be the big winner in the Kentucky primary tonight. Yay! So what? Of course, if my... never mind. I don't like taking my brain to those little... to those places where I think about, you know, what happened. Like I said, I got first 2 weeks of December on the bombing of Iran. Nice flying weather. And you get to Chuckle Nuts? Chuckle Nuts gets to chuckle all the way out of the White House, if he decides to leave, mind you. And hand that bleeding corpse of the beginnings of a war in Iran to President Obama. Enjoy it. I know Bill Clinton did when my daddy did the same thing to him. We're Bushes. We ain't had no original idea for 100 years. Oh, here's another happy story. This coming out of CNBC. You know, I thought it was pretty creepy when John Fox on his program, All Foxed Up, was talking about the possibility of $8 a gallon gas by the end of December. How's this? Quote, "The prices that we're paying at the pump today are, I think, going to be the good old days, because others who watch this very closely forecast that we're going to be hitting $12 and $15 a gallon, and then after that, when world oil production goes into decline, we're going to talk about rationing. That's according to Robert Hirsch, Management Information Services Senior Energy Advisor." And he said it on CNBC. In other words, not only are we going to be paying high prices and have considerable economic problems, but in addition to that, we're not going to be able to get the fuel when we want it. Of course, being the rational person that I am, I can't help adding that it becomes less likely that we will get the fuel that we need if we start a war with Iran. And frankly, that applies no matter how badly the Israeli government wants that war. Again, you pay. I pay. The American people pay. We pay for the war. We pay for the fuel. We pay for the Bear Stearns and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs's to get their little auctions like we talked about earlier in the program. We pay and we pay and we pay. And you know what? Those people are going to giggle their asses off when we're cranking out $15 a gallon. Hirsch said the idea is that world oil production would hit a sharp peak and then drop off. Oh, peak oil? You mean they're finally catching on to peak oil on CNBC? Damn, how long have we been talking about it? How long has Malloy been talking about it? How long has the liberal blogosphere been talking about it? but the light just went on for CNBC. Thank you, for-profit media. Just got around to the story, did you? Ran out of missing white girls and shark attacks and had to really dredge the bottom of the barrel for something like peak oil? Is that what happened? Ugh. $12 a gallon. You know, something like, well, even $4 and $5 a gallon gasoline represents a dramatic change in what it means to be an American. And I know, there are people in other countries that go, so what? You know, you guys are finally catching up. And I understand the inclination to sort of go, you earned this one. And we did. We did. You know, the insurance salesmen who go out to the Cadillac lot and buy the wife a new Escalade that gets 7 miles a gallon. Here, honey, you'll be safe in this. God bless America. They earned it. They earned the $12 a gallon gas. Chrysler Motors turning out the new Challenger that's going to pull down 20 a gallon downhill with a tailwind with its great big honking V8 Hemi head engine that just makes all the gearheads sort of go, swoon. And me too, because I'm a geek. If we just had unlimited gasoline and low, low prices, I would have the absolute flop sweats over that new Dodge Challenger. I'd want me one. But that's another way that we earn it. Lord, the Chrysler Motors, something on the order of 50, 60, 70% of their auto sales are in trucks. I own one from a long, long time ago. And it costs a bunch to put gas in. Once upon a time, well, and there still is a justification for owning that truck, because that thing will go places in the dead of winter with snow on the ground that other things won't go, short of the tank. And when you live, I cut a little slack to people in rural areas, because when you live somewhere that the emergency responders can't get to you in a bind, you better, by God, be able to get to the emergency response center. I say this with some degree of experience, having, what a warm and fuzzy memory this is. Having put Agnes in that truck on Christmas night, 1995, with about 2.5 feet of snow on the road, and the state of West Virginia unwilling to send out the snow plows because they'd have to pay triple time for Christmas. Couldn't see the lines on the road, couldn't see where the road ended and the cliffside began. And drove her 50 miles so that our son could be born. Yeah. No, $4, $5, $10 a gallon gasoline represents a dramatic change in what it means to be an American. Because the America that I grew up in, the cheapest gasoline that I believe I recall as a child, I remember seeing the sign when I first started reading numbers, and I saw a 2, a 9, and a little bitty superscript 9. That's the cheapest gasoline that I remember, and me, you know, being a 45-year-old geezer type. 29.9 a gallon, 30 cents a gallon gas. That's not to suggest, of course, that that was cheap gas, but it was cheaper gas. Or as we said growing up down that way, gas. But gasoline at prices like that meant that a boy growing up in Alabama could see Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. Or the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. and you could go to visit your grandmothers two or three times a year, 600 miles away in West Virginia. That America is disappearing before our very eyes. That America is going the way of the dinosaurs that contributed to make the fuel in the first place. Shh, don't tell the fundies. But it really is. Because America, as of the advent of our love affair with the automobile, and even before that, if you consider the urgency with which the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, America is in love with its vast spaces and the distances between us. We don't live huddled up and cramped up in little tiny buildings laid up against one another like some other places in the world do. We sacrifice neighborhoods for that. Oh, okay, I take that. Yeah, I know. I'm being a rural snob. There are places, and they are cities, and people do live that way. I understand that. But a whole bunch of America doesn't live that way. We grew up in neighborhoods. We grew up in subdivisions. And we grew up in a place where, you know, the grocery store was 3 or 4 miles away, where the only thing that was around us was other houses. No corner markets, no corner baker, no corner butcher. Where you did the living was distinctly separated from where you did the grocering or the gasoline buying or anything else. It was called back then planning. And I look at it and it looks just plain crazy to me. But it was all predicated on the fact that we had unlimited fuel and unlimited land and unlimited resources. And we could all enjoy our own little wide open spaces. And that we didn't have to share walls with each other anymore. And that's going to disappear. It's going to have to be rethought. Because you know what? We're reaching a time where if you left mom and dad to go and find your way in the world, and you were raised in, say, Maryland, and got yourself a job in Idaho or Utah, it will come to the point where that is very similar to the people who left loved ones in the old country to come to America. And we will become even more disjointed and disconnected from each other. And little boys raised in Alabama will not come home to see grandma 3 times a year, 600 miles away in West Virginia, for 2 weeks at a time. Because for one, mommy and daddy won't have jobs that will let them away from the job for that long. And for two, even if they did, they couldn't afford the gas and make next month's rent payment or car payment or insurance payment or house payment or buy food. This isn't doom and gloom. Damn, you know, if that's what reality looks like, deal with it. We can either deal with it or what? Bury our heads in the sand and be like the conservatives who are deemed to be happier than we are because they don't look at the problems that we have in this world? My children, Agnes's children, our children, are going to look, when they're 45, they are going to look at an America that is very, very different from the one that even I look at now, that Agnes and I look at now. it's going to look a lot more like a third world country. Now, see, the sad thing about that's a fact. That's just a fact. I don't care how many flag lapel pins Republicans put on their suit jackets. I don't care how many times they say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing the national anthem or put their hand over their heart or their belly button or anywhere else. It's a fact. And it is not a matter of not loving America enough to talk about these facts. Not talking about these facts has gotten us precisely where we are. Putting up with the horses' asses who have created this reality has gotten us where we are. Sitting on our asses and pretending that everything is okay has gotten us where we are. I mean, just by way of an example, we had a contribution roll in last night, and the message on the little PayPal thingy said $25 extra for the convention fund. And so I've tucked it aside, that $25. And now we're only $2,975 away from being able to do the convention. It's not about that number or that figure. It's about the fact that what used to be a fairly routine, if lengthy, drive, you know, West Virginia to Denver, Colorado. Yeah, you could go and you could do that. And not go broke in the process. But if you take it in light, if you consider that... I have no idea what gasoline will cost. Again, everybody but me and possibly a couple of other people will fly out. I have to drive in order to get the stuff there, because there's no way that I'm air freighting everything that it's going to take to do this broadcast. Because I don't want our computers and our mixing boards and our microphones and all the other stuff that we've busted our asses to have. I don't want to wind up in Denver and have them wind up in... where? Mexico City. Peru, Indiana. Whatever. So we got to drive. And you know what? I'm looking forward to the drive. I think the drive would be fun. But at $5 or $6 a gallon for gas, you know, I figure downhill with a tailwind, 22 miles a gallon, considering, you know, we got to carry people and we got to carry freight. And there'll be stops along the way, and hotel rooms to be gotten, meals to be eaten. You know, that little boy made 3 2-week-a-year trips to West Virginia when he was a kid for probably 3 or 4 years on end for the same money that we're talking about trying to pull together for the Denver run. And that's not out of a sense of extravagance. That's out of a sense of caution. Tires blow out. Things go bad. Cars break down. It's just prudent. But that's, you know, that's also the price that we pay as members of independent media trying to bring some level of basic honesty in reportage to folks who crave facts and an honest delivery of them. That's an example. That's not a pitch, okay? That's I'm trying to create a picture here. This is a different America. The America where Jack Kerouac sets out from New York City in 1947 with a pair of rope huaraches on his feet, hoping to hitchhike across America. When I read that book, when I read On the Road when I was 16 years old, I thought, wow, that's a really different America. Because that was an America where people got on the road and stuck their thumbs out and people actually stopped and gave them rides. That's an America where you could go to the travel service and they'd say, well, you know, I got somebody that's got to get their car from point A to point B. Could you drive it? And you go, yeah, you know, could get part of the way. And I was moved by that different immediate post-war America. And now I suspect that somewhere out there, there is some young American, not applying pen to paper, because we don't do that anymore, but applying fingers to keyboards and watching what happens on the monitor, describing moving around in America in, again, vastly different terms. We are, to call this a paradigm shift, I think, is unfair, because it's more than that. This is a radically different definition of what it means to live in the wide open spaces and call it America. Right? Cindy says, we have to keep our truck. We live in the country, too. We have to keep our truck because we use it to go to the dump once in a while, and we need the 4x4 for ice in the winter because we live on a hill and the cars can't make it up and down. That sounds like here. Also, we need it for occasionally pulling stumps or hauling farm equipment and produce. Yep, again. I don't think country people fall in the same category as city people. A truck is a tool at our place, not an ego extension. Believe me, she says, we burn the least amount of gasoline as possible, a lot less than when we lived in the city. Yeah, we don't keep the roads hot around here. Can't afford to. And that's beautiful. It's a tool. The truck is a tool and not an ego extension. On the other hand, drive into an American city. How many highly polished, looking brand new, showroom perfect 4x4s will you find driving around in parts of the country that have never seen snow? Or even rain? You know what I mean? Am I being a hillbilly elitist when I talk about the woman? And I'm sorry, it's almost always a woman. This isn't sexism. It might be hillbilly elitism, but it isn't sexism. When I see that woman with the W04 sticker on the back of her Escalade, sitting in traffic, talking on her cell phone, and gunning it when the light turns green so that the mileage actually goes even further down. A 4x4... What the hell kind of world do I live in where Cadillac builds four-wheel drive vehicles? When's the last time your average Cadillac Escalade owner went flat tracking in the mud? Hint, they don't. I mean, I've actually got more respect for somebody who goes out and buys a honking gorgeous sedan. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to spend $60,000 on an automobile, you know, and it's not going to be, you know, an RV or something that you're actually going to live in, buy the gorgeous Beamer. Buy the gorgeous Mercedes. Okay, buy American. Buy a really nice, swank Cadillac sedan. Buy a Lincoln. But four-wheel... I don't get it. Well, I do get it because I know the thinking that's behind it. And I was like, well, four-wheel drive SUVs are safer than the other vehicles, Bob. Shh, don't tell them they're not. Two words, or maybe one, roll over. And that's an America that has been handed us that you and I had nothing to do in the making of. I mean, I get the emails here, and I read about other people's lives, and part of the reason I think this program has an appeal to people is that me and that mouse in my pocket. No. Agnes and I and the other folks on the horn, sort of don't have that fourth wall like there is in television. This is real, and we talk about our real life, and I hope that will encourage you to talk about yours. Because see, the little hollaheads, be they Democrat or Republican, who live in Washington, D.C., have no idea what your life is like. They have no idea how offensive it is to see a story out there that the Federal Reserve held a little auction, you know, for the investment houses. At the same time that we can't even get a GI Bill of Rights for the 21st century through the Congress that the Democrats control both houses of. They have no idea. And to the extent they have an idea, a lot of them don't give a damn. Some do. Some do. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, those people who take lobbying money from coal companies and oil companies and natural gas companies and all the insurance industry and the banking industry, they don't give a tinker's damn about you. And don't kid yourself or try to delude yourself into thinking that they do. The only way you could possibly matter to them, apart from going and doing, you know, holding your nose and choosing the lesser of two evils in November, the only way you could possibly matter to them is if you were to win the damn lottery and give them a big chunk of it. Then, you know, they'd take your phone calls. But not a minute before. So, just think about this, and I'd be interested in your input. What does America on $10 a gallon gas look like? What happens to $10 a gallon America? Because it's not just the $10 a gallon that you're putting in your tank, it's the $10 a gallon, and frankly, if gasoline's $10 a gallon, diesel's going to be what, 14? What's your gallon of milk going to cost? What's a dozen eggs going to cost? What's canned food going to cost if it's not poisoning you to eat food out of it by then? Because I've got this other story here about something that I haven't read up enough on to be feel confident of talking about, something called bisphenol A, which is a chemical that is used to line cans. Yeah, News Ninja Gene says, forget about going out to dinner. Not only forget about going out to dinner, but a whole bunch of the food service industry can forget about having a job. The places that sell food very poor and very cheap will continue. You know, McDonald's ain't going out of business anytime soon. They're going to sell crap forevermore, because there are people who will buy it. And the very most well-to-do of the restaurants, they'll keep going, because $10 a gallon gas doesn't matter to somebody who makes $1 million a year. $10 a gallon gas doesn't matter to somebody who makes $150,000 a year. It means you eat out maybe twice a week instead of three times. So there's that. How about, well, you know what's going to happen here in the hills. $10 a gallon gas will be used as an excuse for ramping up the war on Appalachia in ways that I and my friends in the anti-mountaintop removal movement have probably not even contemplated. That's not selling them short. It's just that the funny thing about that, though, is that gasoline has very little to do with electricity generation, but it will still be used as a reason to blow up more mountains faster. Maybe we can go from 3 million pounds of high explosives per day used on West Virginia to 6 million. Do I hear 9? Sold out. For me, it makes sense to think about this kind of stuff. For me, if I've imagined it, I won't be quite so shocked when it becomes a reality. You understand how my twisted little mind works? Another little piece of the economic puzzle. Reuters is reporting that an imminent recession may cost 59,400 jobs in New York City alone. Almost 60,000 jobs between now and the middle of next year. Reuters is suggesting that the profit-stricken financial sector will be the epicenter of the downturn, which, of course, I mean, there's kind of good news in that, because we know that the federal government will step in to bail out the troubled investment houses. They just won't bail out the people who mop the floor and clean the windows of the troubled investment houses. Those almost 60,000 jobs, that represents almost a quarter of all the hiring by private employers after the 2001 recession. Well, the Lord Bush giveth and the Lord Bush taketh away. What happens in New York City when 59,400 people hit the bricks? What happens to social service agencies? What happens to healthcare providers? What happens to financial institutions who have loans out to people who are dutifully paying off their loans until it turned out that they were no longer able to do so? If that happens in New York City, what's going to happen in Chicago? What's the number going to be in Houston? What's the number going to be in Atlanta? What's it going to be like in Philly? How about Boston? How about Seattle? How about Portland? How about San Francisco and San Diego and L.A.? How about Dallas, Kansas City? Because everything they talk about in New York City will be manifested by some sort of reality in the other big cities. The Independent Budget Office's new estimate assumes that Wall Street will hemorrhage 33,300 jobs. According to the article, the question I was asking a minute ago has the following answer. Each job on Wall Street creates another 2 to 3 jobs in other industries in New York, from law firms to, yes, restaurants. Wall Street employees earn about 35% of all salaries and wages in New York City. Wow, no wonder we're in trouble. When 35% of the wages of the biggest city in America are earned by people who are shuffling electrons, yeah, that could be a problem. Not saying that they're not working hard shuffling the electrons, but they're shuffling electrons. I mean, you can't go buy a pair of shoes at Goldman Sachs now, can you? You know, if the old toaster burns out in the kitchen, they don't have a toaster section of Morgan Stanley, do they? Mayor Bloomberg said, given the chaos in the financial markets, which makes it so difficult to get financing, we're still doing spectacularly well, he said, stuffing another hummingbird tongue into his gaping maw. He also said, however, that Wall Street companies typically seek big refunds months after they discover they overpaid their taxes. Oh, what a dodge. But he did notice that note that it's a bigger crunch on the middle class than the upper one. He said it's a heck of a lot easier to sell a $400,000 car than it is to sell a $70,000 car. $70,000? Jeez, let's see. 5 into 7, 1 times 1 times 7 minus 5 to 20. You could buy 14 of my truck. You know, so there's the partial answer to the question. What does America look like? But they keep insisting, you know, when they're not calling it a funk, on calling it a recession. What happened? I'm not, you know, Mark Levine's the economics guy. The dismal science, as he calls it. That's not me. What has to happen before you start using real, you know, honest-to-goodness reality in the language? What has to happen when you stop calling it a funk and start calling it a recession? And what has to happen to get you to stop calling it a recession and start calling it a depression? What has to happen to stop calling it a depression and start calling it a collapse? So, you know, that's just me. $10 gas at our house, the grass would be 5 feet deep in a month. The gardens would be kept for survival. Steve would ride his bike to work, or the holler out of here would have to figure out a pool to town. Soup lines, if you can get the soup. Cold houses, lots of heavy clothing in the winter. It'd cost me $40 to go to the doctor. I'd have to do it if I want to stay on my feet. You know what? We'd be better off than most because we could sell food and we have our own well. Yeah, I used to feel pretty good about the well we have around here. But now that the blasting's back up and going again, God only knows what's going to happen to that. Sorry, these things just, you know, occur to me. Let's see. You know what? I'm pretty much done for the evening. I don't want to end. Oh, yeah. No. Wait a minute. Happy note. You know, I used to joke about how every night we have our obligatory Star Trek reference. Well, tonight's obligatory Star Trek reference goes out to George Takei, Mr. Sulu. Mr. Sulu is 71 years old. Mr. Sulu lives in California. And Mr. Sulu can finally get married. Happy for him. He's marrying his 54-year-old partner. They've been together 21 years. George Takei said on his website, "We can have the dignity as well as all the responsibilities of marriage. We embrace it all heartily." Good on you, George. Wish I had a bunch of money. I'd send him and Mr. Altman a place setting of china with the Federation seal in the middle of the plate. That would be appropriate. Or maybe some monogram towels with the Federation seal on it. Sorry, I'm a Trekkie. I really am. So, okay, we had a happy thing. Congratulations. Congratulations going out to George Takei. And the question is, why can't other people in other states have the same rights that they've finally gotten around to having in California? And that, incidentally, the right wing will do everything in its power to take away by overriding it with a popular vote, creating a constitutional amendment that determines what can go on when the lights go off. Nice little tribute George has given his partner. We've traveled the world together from Europe to Asia to Australia. We've shared the good times as well as struggled through the bad. He helped me care for my ailing mother who lived with us for the last years of her life. He is my love, and I can't imagine life without him. And somehow or another, that is deemed offensive to the bigots that inhabit this country. And what a pity that is. On the way, a best-of recording of Peter Godbold's Strictly Confidential. After that, maybe a horn section. And I'm pretty sure all foxed up with John Fox. The program comes to you every night by virtue of the hardest-working, bravest people I know. Partial sponsorship through Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. It also comes to you because there are those of you out there who care about having this program and real, unfiltered, unprofitized, uncorporatized information. And that's not just this show, that's every show on the horn. And you keep us going via your contributions via the PayPal button at the website headonradionetwork.com and by your contributions via snail mail to 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia 25801. And we are humbled beyond your imagination and inspired to get behind the mic, each and every one of us, every night, to make it happen again. So thank you. Thanks to Peter Godbold, thanks to John Fox, IT professional and chief engineer, respectively. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org makes sure that the streams, the archives, and the podcasts of all the programs on the horn are always there for you. Drop a note to Ben. Thank him sometime. He can also use a buck or two whenever you can drop those as well. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.